Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You can tell when somebody really enjoyed what they were working on and loved working on it. And I like to think that everybody can tell that we're enjoying our games and having fun with them ourselves.
Yeah. When I read a game, I want to know something that the designer loves. I want to read, I don't know very much about cars, but I want, you know, I'm always excited to read a game about cars written by someone who clearly knows what a slip differential is and cares enough to take me on that journey.
Welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast, the show that calls on the champions and new contenders of the tabletop RPG arena. My name is Jeremy Gage, and I am learning about tabletop game design and publishing. If you are a budding game designer or a veteran looking for fresh musings, stay tuned as we learn about the inspirations, processes, and philosophies of professionals in the industry. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to the Draw Your Dice show podcast episode number unknown. I don't know where I'm at. But what's really special about today is that this is the first cooperative inaugural duel show. I'm so excited. I'm so excited to bring to you the designers behind Gem Room Games. I'd like to welcome to the show Dan Phipps and Collie Laurie.
Thank you. Oh, I want to wait to make sure the applause dies down from the stands. Yeah, exactly. Please. I mean, do go on. But
it's a pleasure to have you both here.
Yeah, thank
today.
You for inviting us.
I met Dan through the Brain Trust, per many of my guests, and I've been hearing great things about Collie as well through the Twitters whenever Gem Room Games pops up in my feed. For those who may not know who you are, Dan and Collie, would you just give a brief introduction for each of you and maybe also a brief introduction for Gem Room Games as well?
Sure. So I'm Dan Phipps. I never know how to start introductions. So
why don't we start with Gem Room Games?
Let's start with Gem Room Games. So we're Gem Room Games. We're based in Southern California near Glendale, and we make indie tabletop RPGs. How long have we been doing this? Been doing this for a little...
Four to five years, I think?
4 to 5 years. We released our first... We spent a lot of time in development, but we released our first game about 2 years ago.
Yeah, we sort of crept into being with Dan doing games that he was working on ostensibly by himself, and then I was coming in to playtest and to consult and then to edit, and eventually it was sort of like, well, we've been doing this together for a while now, so we may as well officially do this together.
Sort of make explicit what was implicit. But so, yeah, we, about 2 years ago, we released High Magic Low Lives, which was the first thing that we...
Official
generally. Yeah, and that was essentially taking something that I'd been working on for a very long time and essentially handing it over to Kali for complete editorial control so that it actually made sense outside of my brain. And then since then, we made Subway Runners, which we had the chance to submit to the Itch.io Racial Justice Bundle. And then we had a second kid. And then there was a long drought. And then very recently, we released Duckburg. And 2 days ago, Neutron Axe or something, because we decided to take a break from making games by making another game.
Dan comes up to me. We're officially on our quiet break time. And he says, well, do you think we've got 6 days? Can we get something out? And 5 days later, we submitted. So that's our spare time game.
Yeah, that was... it turns out doing other work is not the same as rest. That was a big takeaway from that experience. But yeah. And yeah, we sell through Itch.io, and so far we're pretty much exclusively in the PDF slinging game. And yeah, I guess going backwards from Gem Room Games into who we are as individual people. So Kali and I met at library school at UCLA, and I was there to study informatics, which I should have known was a mistake when I didn't know what that meant. It's basically like library stuff, but on computers. But no one had caught up to the fact that library stuff was happening on computers anyways. So a lot of stuff about, you know, what happens to all your digital files when... One sec, I think it's chirping like crazy, which is weird because I told it not to do that. And I want to make sure that is not happening in a... Oh my god.
I'm chill. I'm vibing. I'm loving this.
Okay. Do not make any noises to me ever again.
Screaming at Siri or Google Home. Yeah. Google Home, quiet.
Yeah, hopefully that stops. What was I talking about?
You were talking about who you are. Oh, informatics.
Yeah. So, I did a big presentation on, like, what happens to digital objects in a disaster. Because, in theory, everything you back up on a computer is, like, preserved forever. But in practice, it has to physically go on a magnetic tape or a magnetic platter, and magnets degrade over time, and it, you know.
People get real excited about the idea of keeping stuff forever, forgetting that forever is a really long time.
Yes, famously. So that's what I studied, and
yeah, so I went from art school to library school studying craft, mostly art that has to do with a lot of fabric and traditional craft techniques. And from there, went to library school, hoping to break into a really stable line of work, which, well, at least I met Dan. We started going to the same board game night, and he, after I got a bit tired of dudes at this board game night explaining to me a lot how to play board games, Dan invited me to a playtest he was running of a game that he had designed, and that was the first RPG I played. And yeah, then I started playing them more and getting into this and having a lot of thoughts about how to make RPGs in a way that is friendly to somebody who didn't necessarily grow up playing D&D.
Wow, what a beautiful story. Thank you for taking me on that journey through library school. And now it doesn't sound great also.
I've got mixed feelings about library school.
Yeah. It's one of those, I feel like there's a lot of schools like this in different areas of education where probably you can learn most of what you need just by doing the job, and unless you really want to get your PhD, then really your experience is going to cover 90% of what you're going to learn, and you're going to think you know everything, and then you get out of school and kind of go, oh, crap, because it's not all applicable to an actual practical experience. Mm-hmm. Still valuable. That, like, last 10% can really help you figure out the practical experience, but it is not the, you go in and you learn everything and ta-da, you are an expert for life situation that some people might believe.
Yeah, I think I'd give grad school in general 3 stars on it. You know, I got something out of it, but shouldn't have had to do that. But it worked out.
I totally agree. I went to culinary school in Pittsburgh, and the second I found like actual prep cook work, it was just like all thrown out the window because I was learning inflated concepts about classical cuisine and old European techniques, and I'm like, okay, but where's the world going with food? And I go to this Asian Latin fusion sushi bar place. I'm like, none of this works here.
No.
Please help me. Most I got was knife skills.
I studied archives, and in library school, you get a real sense that every single thing that was ever made is the most precious and ought to be saved. And then you get a job and it's sort of like, okay, but saving all that stuff actually costs money, and mm-hmm. not a lot of institutions have just endless money to pay for space and preservation and so on. So mm-hmm. you kind of have to get over all those ideas of things being precious that you left school with.
Yeah, going into records management was an even bigger shock because not only is it like, yeah, like we're legally obligated to get rid of stuff, and if we don't, then it can be subpoenaed. So we're getting rid of it. Like, we're fulfilling our legal obligation, and then we are cutting it out. So I had to unlearn a lot about, you know, ooh, but how can we keep it forever? Like, well, should you be, though? Like, maybe don't have done that.
You know, I feel like this does roll over to Gem Room Games, because our games are well-organized and kind of follow the legal line of what we must include, and otherwise, can we cut it out?
Yeah. Which is one of that's definitely an arc from High Magic Low Lives, which is like a lot of pages. I don't know how many pages. It's
like
long.
A 2-hour character creation, and it's glorious.
Yeah, no,
it's
so
much
works.
Fun.
I'm happy with it, but I've also like, that's the one that I keep thinking like, should I go back and like fix it? And it's like, no, let it be what it is. People enjoy it, and they like it for the things that you think you can fix, and endlessly tinkering is no good. But then Neutron Axe, which we, thanks to the Trifold Jam, we were finally had a sort of commitment to, okay, if it doesn't fit on a single piece of paper, then, like, it's not going in. So you're going to have to articulate this broad concept of, I don't know, how to get hit points back, and like, you've got 2 lines, bucko, and
yeah.
we are not making this font any smaller.
I want to fit as many tiny points into this as possible. All amazing. I am excited to talk about, we're going to talk about both Neutron Axe and Duck Bork in just a second, but as an additional icebreaker to the show, as always, just show people the different paths everyone takes to game design. Kali, what was sort of your first RPG experience you sort of already dabbled in meeting Dan, and then what was sort of the first game that got you thinking about making tabletop games?
As I mentioned, I kind of slowly waded into it, and actually at one point had advised Dan to try an exercise in his design process, which was just to make a game a month. Just a little zine game, one a month, and bang them out, learn a lesson from what he was doing, and move on to the next one. And as he was doing that, I started seeing it as a more approachable thing that a person could do without necessarily having a big game design background. And then after he finished that project, I think that's about the point when we started more officially acknowledging that I was working on games.
Yeah, it started just as a sort of editor thing, and mm-hmm. then that has expanded very quickly because you, I mean, when you're, you know, as I'm sure people have talked about on this show an awful lot. Like, you're wearing a lot of hats when you make a game, so anything to be sort of like, I don't, man.
Dan kept adding words after my name on the credit page, and eventually it was sort of like, yeah, okay, I'm just making these games also.
Yeah.
It sounds like you had a really strong intuition for picking up the language, the intent behind. I mean, were you playing games a lot throughout your life, or was this a recent thing in college when you went to library school?
That first game that Dan invited me to was really my first game. I needed to learn what TTRPG stood for. Before that, really, I didn't play video games. I didn't really play much in the way of board games or anything like that. My coming into it more was with an understanding of writing clearly and of some level of visual design as a visual artist, less with a real understanding of how games worked. But that also is a lot of what brought me in, because I did want to make sure that as Dan was writing these games, that he was writing them for anyone, that anyone could pick up one of these games and understand at least how to get started without needing a big background. Like, I noticed for a while I was trying to get into video games and realized pretty quickly that most video games assume that you've been playing since Duck Hunt or whatever and have a basic understanding of what the different keys do and how these things work, and they don't need to explain that to you. And then for somebody like me who didn't grow up playing them, it's just really confusing. That's a lot of barrier to entry. And a lot of the games, a lot of the RPGs on Dan's shelf also make similar assumptions that you've grown up playing these things, you understand all the shorthand and the mechanics, and that's really frustrating if you haven't grown up with these things, to try to jump into that and just hit a wall of not understanding and not knowing what's going on. So that was actually something that I brought to Gem Room Games, was really wanting to make sure that anyone could pick up a game and not find themselves alienated by shorthand or by a writing style that assumed something that wasn't necessarily accurate.
I love that. That's very, very cool. And I think one of the things you and I share here, Kali, is that I'm also, like, as I talk with a lot of these designers, I'm super new to game design, period. I have played video games for a long portion of my life, but I didn't start playing, like, D&D until 4 years ago. So a lot of, like, interactive game lingo and techniques are super obscure to me and abstract, so I feel a sort of relation to reading a book that has a language that says, like, oh, you know how, like, dice and probability and all this stuff works. Like, you'll get it. You'll totally get it. Like, I don't get it. I literally don't understand what's happening here. So that's very, very cool. Dan, how about you? What was your first sort of tabletop role-playing game? What made you decide that you wanted to design?
So I played tabletop RPGs for a bit in, like, middle and high school. I think the first game I played ever was third edition D&D, but that was only, like, a one-off gimmick that, like, a guy in the neighborhood was like, check out this book, and then we, like, sat down and played once, and it was like, okay, neat, and then that was kind of it. The first game I played where it was sort of a long-form thing was Warhammer Fantasy 2nd Edition, which set me up with really weird expectations for what a tabletop RPG is, because that's a game where when you're making a character, you roll for your name. Like, you don't get to pick your name. Your parents named you. Why would you get to pick your name? And it's very, you know, very underlines this, like, oppressive, medieval, Inquisition-y setting through character creation and through this sort of, like, all right, you're this weird guy who has this randomly selected job because it's medieval society and you don't get to pick what you do, and, like, now go get, you know, killed by beastmen or something. And the first time I GM'd was, I think, fourth edition Shadowrun, and it just didn't work. Like, I just couldn't. I tried to run a couple of games from that sort of, in the early aughts, and not a one of them, like, I didn't get it. Like, I'd read it, kind of, and then there's, like, nothing doing. Later, I ran 4th edition, which I know you've been reading a bit, and it was like, oh, they actually, the Dungeons Master's Guide actually guides Dungeon Masters. What a novel concept. And, like, that I could actually run. And so that was when I started getting back into, like, getting into RPGs and, like, bringing my, like, way cooler hipster friends on this journey with me of like, hey, want to be an elf? And the first game I played where it was like, oh, I could probably do this, was when Fantasy Flight did their Star Wars games. They did, I think, Edge of the Empire was the first one, where it was just like, oops, all Han Solos. And it was like, oh, like by, because it was a little bit thinner than, and a little bit more oblique how the game actually works, which everyone else was learning through PBTA. Everyone else was like learning that success and complications can be different axes and like ways to sort of interact with that. And I was learning it through Fantasy Flight's weird proprietary dice system that is intentionally set up so that you can't recreate it without fancy dice. But after that was when I started messing around with trying to make a game. And I spent a long time, I spent like years tinkering with this game called Arroyo, that if I just known when to go to, I would have made like six games, because it was like real ship of Theseus hours, except it was like a ship that was a car, and then a submarine, and then like a plane, and then like a building. Like it just,
I think I came in during the submarine phase.
Yeah, you were some big submarine era energy, but yeah, it's so like, that was a real, like that was the sort of response to that was, okay, no, I have 1 month. Like, I've got 1 month, and I've got, like, I finally accepted that, like, I had to stop tinkering with this thing that I didn't even know. Like, I didn't know how Drive-Thru RPG worked, or, like, what was I going to do with this PDF once I had it. So I started making zines, and I made Nine Lives of Valhalla, laid out on Microsoft PowerPoint, which I do not recommend. It did not look good, but it... No, I actually, it came out, it looked fine.
It worked for the medium.
It worked for the medium, especially if you have a magnifying glass, because it, like, the font came out tiny out the printer. But, and I think a game called Teeny Tiny Terraformers, that sort of worked. Yeah, it was a fun premise based on an alliterative title. And yeah, and ever since then, it's just been trying to manage scope, and then
with occasionally me coming in and being like, no, that's done, it's going to print, we're done,
please stop trying to tinker with this mechanic, Dan, it needs to be done. So yeah, so that was sort of the arc to us having a kitchen table conversation about starting a I don't know, game company.
Yeah,
I guess we're a company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
this is what I'm hearing right now is that this is the fabled power couple that so many people look for in their lives.
It's definitely come together. It feels that way. Yeah.
We are definitely a couple.
Yes.
Powerful. You are also, I love it. I love both of your journeys. Very cool. And I love that there's this very synergistic quality to the different paths you take in your life. I think it's very cool. I'm in high respect of it. Well, with that, let's get into the meat and potatoes. Let's talk about these games, shall we? Let's open with, because you're so excited about it, let's open with Duckborg. So you made Duckborg as a supplement to the very popular, as of current, Workborg. Why? Why ducks? Why Borg? Why Duckborg?
So the
Dan has a lot of dad puns.
So it's a very, you know, there are people who do mechanics first design. This is pun first design. Actually, legitimately,
would you say it's a principle of gem room?
I mean, I actually do think if you can come up with a good title for a game, then like you should probably make it, because the hardest thing in the world is when you have a game and you need a title. So if you have the title, then the hardest work
is. Oh yeah, this is why, you know, I've got an upcoming project coming out someday, maybe, called Havoc Knight, because isn't that a fun name?
Yeah. Who's the Havoc Knight? Cool. What does he do? Don't worry about it.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, that's tomorrow's problem. So the Morkborg official channel teased something that they were going to make called Cyborg, which is like, well, that was that obviously in retrospect. Why did someone not scoop Stockholm Cartel on Cyborg? And I think there was a lot of alternate Borg chat on the Brain Trust, and at some point I knew we had a hit when I typed "Life is like a hurricane here in Duckburg," and the immediate response was "F off, Dan." So I knew that was a hit.
I think that when Dan told me that, I sort of went, okay, and left the room.
Yep, so clearly a winner. That was back in October. It's about to be April now. We released it in March. So it took a long time to get there. And I mean, that was it. It was sort of like, okay, if this joke is still funny in a week, then we'll make the game. And it was.
It turns out it was funny months later still.
Yeah, I still think it's really good. So we reached out to Rob Hebert, who is a...
Paper Games.
Of Nerdy Paper Games. That's his itch.io is Nerdy Paper Games, and everyone should go follow him there. Because he's a game designer and an illustrator who we've been threatening to do a collaboration for a long time, but it never quite materialized. And he had the perfect style for this, because he A, would get it, like, and B, he knows the like Disney style really well, but like it wouldn't. Like, I feel like the death of this thing would be having to explain Morkborg, or Merkborg, rather. And so, we reached out to him for the art, and then had a second kid, and that was...
We put in a little bit of work on it before the second kid. Then came the second kid, and High Magic Low Lives we put out when our first kid was, what, like 2 weeks old or so? And this time I did a lot of talking to Dan in the lead up, saying we're not going to do that again. We're not going to do that. So instead we put out a game when our second kid was like 2 months old. Big difference.
Six whole weeks.
Yeah.
And yeah, what we ended up doing, because what we wrote was like 40 pages. Like it was expansive. And what we ended up doing, because I was starting to get in my own head about the project, and, you know, but we really wanted to do it, and I think it was your idea to break it up into rounds so that we could actually get something out there.
Well, and we wanted also, you know, there's that cartoon that is owned by a powerful company, and they were having their series finale on March 15th, and we thought, well, that would be a fun time to put out our game in a very, you know, total coincidence. They've got nothing to do with each other. Legally, very distinct properties, but... Also, we weren't really ready to put out the entirety of it on that date, so we were talking about how itch.io works and how they like the dev blog and so on. Figured out how to make that work for our timeline with this game, with the different drops of material that sort of took some of the immediate pressure of needing to finish something now, and instead made it into a finish it when we've had a chance to do a really good job with it and still put it out.
Also, this was our first time making an RPG with like real layout software. So there was an element of like, oh, we're doing a Morkborg, huh? That's a lot of spreads. So yeah, we're right now, what's out there now is round one. And then in May, we're going to release round two, which is going to have a lot of locations and some more monsters.
Yeah,
and
round one was sort of everything that you would need to get started and play a basic game of it. And round two sort of introduces you more into the world with with the locations and the treasures and things like that. And then in collaboration with Rob, we'll set a date for round three that'll really flush out that world with all of the people that you might meet, the different characters, and the what I think is one of Dan's best pieces of writing for the game, The Fate of Duckborg, which is...
The people who are familiar with Merkborg, my favorite thing about that game is that at the beginning of every day, you roll a die, and if you roll a one, you have to read one of the psalms that prophesy the end of the world. And that is just true now. And eventually you run out. You kind of decide as a table how long you want the world to live. And that determines how big of a die you roll to, like, everything from a d20 to, like, flip a coin. And when you run out, the world ends. And that's just how the game of Merkborg ends. And I think, rules as written, you also burn the book. But
we don't recommend burning our PDF.
Yeah.
Unless you printed it out, go ham, but don't burn your computer.
You can delete the PDF because you can re-download it from itch.io. But you can symbolically, like, you know... You can put it on a flash drive and throw it in a lake or something. But
maybe don't do that.
That's littering. Don't do that. I'm winking. The punchline of this whole thing is we rewrote the DuckTales theme song to fit the psalms, and I'm very excited. I'm very excited. There's so many hurricanes and race cars and lasers and aeroplanes that are going to be happening to people. And it has to be last. It has to be the third round because it needs so much more like that's, we couldn't have done it right if we tried to rush it in this one. And so we're giving it, that's our big finale in summer, I hope, is when that'll drop. And then Duckburg will be complete, and hopefully by then people will still, the hope, my biggest hope for this is that this time the response was really, really positive. People were really into it, and a lot of it, as was intended and is appropriate, is because it is a very silly pun and that lands well. I'm hoping by the time summer rolls around, when we're talking about, hey, we have even more Duckburg, that people will be genuinely excited to, like, you know, deal with Magicka Dispel with the serial number filed off and, like, you know, explore a surreal, because you watch DuckTales and it's weird. Like, it's a weird place that doesn't make a lot of sense and, you know, and translates to dark fantasy easier than you would think necessarily. So that's the hope. It may not actually materialize. People might be kind of like, didn't we do this already? But, like, I mean,
if nothing else, we're still excited about it. So it'll be good to finish it and feel really good about the thing that we've made.
Round three might be just for us, but and you know, the way itch.io works, like, the file will just update, so we can just email everyone and say, hey, re-download it, there's more pages to that thing you got. But I think it's really sort of, the goal is to transcend the goof and like make it into a, you know, I don't know what you call it, like a Pinocchio-esque real boy of a Merkborg conversion.
Has to overcome the three trials before it becomes a real game.
A real module.
It's got to escape from a whale. Someone's going to try and turn it into a donkey.
I
don't remember anything else in that movie.
Go to the circus?
There's a circus.
Isn't there drinking?
There's drinking on an island.
This game is definitely underage.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. I haven't given Merkborg a real read yet, and I didn't know about the Psalm sort of forced clock rules, and I love that you incorporated that in this module. I'm always thinking, like, in my own personal designs, I'm always thinking about how to, like, force the game to a close because one of the things I dislike about D&D 5e campaigns and how it sort of instructs you to play is like it's the never ending story, essentially. And you get to this you get to session 50, you're meandering, and then you have to go full reset because you totally forgot why you started this campaign in the first place. So, and I think it's beautifully creative that you use the theme song to make that happen. I love it. I would love to see more of that. If Gem Room Games became known for converting every like childhood cartoon show into a dark fantasy RPG or something of the like,
go before we get some cease and desist notices.
Oh well, that's the gold ring on this is if we can get a C&D from Disney. Like, I'm not optimistic on that. The person who gorilla shot a movie called Escape from Tomorrowland in actual Disneyland still hasn't gotten the takedown. So if they're good, we're good. But I don't know. I don't know how. I'm not a lawyer.
What is law?
What is law? Baby, don't hurt me. That is actually our position towards the Disney Corporation. It's like, no, please. I have a family. But yeah, I mean, I learned a lot about Merkborg as a game and as an art object. Like, we kind of did a deep dive into it that was way deeper than my first read. You know, you only have to look at the cover to come up with a pun based on the name. But, you know, like, there's a lot that, from a purely mechanics perspective, and then I want to give Kali a chance because she did a lot of the layout. But from the design side of it, the first time I read it, it felt too thin to me. And like, oh, I see why this is good, but this isn't my, like, thing. Because I do like a little bit more. Like, I really like your Blades in the Dark-y, like, still indie storytelling, but, like, there's some mechanical heft behind it, and, like, you get to roll dice an awful lot and so on. And what I ended up really appreciating about Merkborg is how much, like, it's what they did include is very driving and very strong. Like, there's a bunch of monsters, and they're totally messed up and dark and weird, and some of them are like actually. One of them was like, I read it and I was like, well, I'm going to bed. That was upsetting. There's like a porcelain doll that's like haunted in a super.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, not great. But the inclusion of like, oh, and like, here's, okay, there's a troll, and here's how much its corpse is worth, and here's how much it's worth alive, and here's how much a troll claw is worth, and like the breakdown in silver, like, immediately it's sort of like, oh, so I could run like a whole session, maybe a whole campaign on like, there's a troll and it's worth 200 silver if you can bring it mm-hmm. back here alive. And that's retiring money, my dude. And it's not going to work because it's a troll and you're three misbegotten weirdos. But like, you know, rather in lieu of a GM's advice guide that breaks down, you know, hey, here's like an incentive structure or whatever. It's just like, here's a fact about trolls that like maybe you let the players know and that will drive it. And that's not necessarily something like if we set out to write, you know, I mean, we're hewing very close to Merkborg in style for Duckburg because that's the only way it's going to work. If we were writing it whole cloth, we probably would take a different approach. Like, just in the way we tend to write. But I really, like, appreciated a lot of, you know, it is not a coincidence, and it is not merely the, like, layout and art that is driving the fandom of it. Like, I became more of a fan of it through having to write in that style. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good exercise and something that I kind of want to do more is like, okay, well, what do I not get? And I'll just make content for it until I understand it.
And Kali, you want to talk about the visual design for sure. This project as well?
Well, before getting started, really, the first thing that I did was just spend like a couple hours just looking at the book and taking notes on how they shaped things and their colors and fonts and the way that they used things and the way that they broke down their tables and where they placed art, so on. And it was so interesting because before I did that, I had this impression, which I heard a lot of other people echoing, that the visual design of that game is just sort of pow, in your face, bold craziness, that it puts the aesthetic almost above your being able to play and understand the game. But the more time I spent looking at how they laid things out, the more impressed I was with how clear it is, how easy they make that information to understand, despite, well, I say despite, but, you know, they do so much visually, and it almost gives you this impression that that would make it harder to understand, but it actually is really helping you to understand, to get the information that you need. So that allowed me to really just sort of build a skeleton for us to then lay our words and art on top of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, like, it became clear there are pages where it's very art-heavy, and, like if the page is just a table, it'll be laid out and stylized in a very different way compared to, hey, this is how hit points work. Like, they're both very big and very bombastic, but, like...
But also, all of their tables are actually really simply laid out. It's just the visual presentation kind of makes you think, oh, this is some wild and crazy table. It's actually a really beautifully simple table. They've just decorated it very well.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's... And this is obviously, like, if... It does create a barrier in an accessibility sense, right? Like, that's... And something that we had to figure out really early on was, like, okay, like, clearly you can't just do more layout to it to, like, to capture the style. Like, there's a
restraint.
There's a restraint to it. And also, it was important to us to sort of evoke the Morkborg aesthetic and layout style and so on, but also make sure, or at the very least do our best to not create something that's overwhelming for a person who might, you know, who would be, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, put off by the noise, right? Because it is very chaotic and it is very stylized, and that's, you know, it does pose an accessibility concern. And so something that we're probably, you know, I mean, this isn't necessarily going to be the big marketing push on it, but I think, you know, we're trying to get more familiar with accessibility in that sense of, like, what does a screen reader do with this? You know, that's something that, like, is becoming... It's not becoming more of a priority, but it's something that we're making sure that, like, it's part of the workflow of, like, okay, before this goes to print, you know, with...
Yeah, we just, with Neutron X, we just included our first distinct screen-readable version that you can download when or instead of you download the main game. And I was, before we uploaded it, I was listening to the PDF and realizing, oh, there's so many little things in the way that we've been formatting that I didn't think about. I just went, oh yeah, this heading looks good, and didn't realize that the lack of a period would cause the screen reader to read that a little differently than we might have intended. So we've been learning about things like that and wanting to, you know, I talked earlier about how much we've wanted people who don't necessarily have an RPG background to find our works inviting and accessible to them in that way. And this is a new sort of accessible for us that we're trying to develop to really make sure that there aren't any groups of people that we are alienating or leaving out. We want everyone to be able to pick up a Gem Room Games game and enjoy it.
Yeah, I think, you know, this started, like, very early on being very GM focused, because I still have a chip on my shoulder from not being able to run games from the 2000s. And so, you know, thinking a lot about, you know, the sort of the designer, to the game as a document, to the GM, who's probably the person who bought the book, who then has to go to a group of players and pitch it, and then has to know how to run the game. And how do you sort of get, how do you have a message that can be carried from each person, you know, so that it's a pitchable game, so that people will actually be able to play it. And, you know, like, it doesn't matter if they play it as intended, but they should be able to, like, not, they should have something to kick off from, you know, like, mm-hmm. something that sort of says, okay, if you do, if you have these five things, you can run a game. You know, you need a monster and a treasure and a spooky place, and you'll be fine, or whatever.
Something I learned about Dan as a GM pretty early on was that he would pick up a book and read it and then go, I'm not going to do that part, and yeah. just start cutting out, like, whole chapters and slipping in mechanics he preferred or just skipping that whole section. And because of my watching him do that, I sort of look at all of our games with the expectation that people are going to do that. They're going to take the parts that work for them and roll with that. And we want that to always be okay.
Yeah,
we don't want the game to completely fall apart because you cut out something that wasn't working for you.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, like that was... That started being the priority, but as, you know, we've learned more and read other people's games more and gotten an increasingly rare opportunity to actually play a game, which it's so much easier to write games than to play them now. Like, getting six people to sit down in a Zoom is, like, impossible these days. But but writing a game, you can just do that when your kid wakes you up at 5 a.m. and you can't get back to sleep. But, you know, like there are ways to help people be good players, and there are ways to, you know, like, think about safety tools and to make sure that, you know, I know full well that there are people who have thought really, really hard about making really good safety tools. I don't need to reinvent that wheel, but I can sort of make the negative space where the safety tools that are preferred will fit into our game. And, you know, like, setting people up to have, you know, goals as a character and to, you know, sort of interact with other characters to make more fun and so on. Like, that's, you know, like, we're not, there's no good will come of us being precious about the design, but, like, this sort of broad accessibility definition of sort of providing on-ramps for people from a lot of different backgrounds, but also, you know, and we're probably... Once we get a rhythm that we like, because I got to learn, I know academically what an EPUB, no idea how to make one. Like, if I hit the save as PDF button, I've got a PDF, and Itch.io will give me money for it sometimes, and that's great. But, like, that's sort of a thing that I'm really looking to figure out, or get it as an HTML document, or something that, because PDFs are rough stuff, man. You copy paste from a PDF and you get word salad on the other side.
Tell me about it.
This got pretty far afield, but yeah, it's
but Duckburg.
Yeah, I think Duckburg. You know, it didn't make it into round one, and it's something that I think is going to be a priority for later rounds. But, like, doing the deep dive into the Merkborg style and the writing and so on kind of showed both sides of, like, oh, like, you can do this. Like, we can tweak the text so it's all slightly rotated and has this, like, great jumbled feel. And, like, A, who are we bringing in with that? Like, who likes Merkborg, who we're bringing in? And also, kind of, who are we pushing away a little bit? And that's okay for Duckburg, because that was the intent. Like, it's very... You know what you're getting with this, because it is very difficult for me to imagine someone buying Duckburg before Morkburg, or, like, not being aware of the existence of them.
We have been told people are doing that.
People have bought Merkborg so they can play Duckburg, which is the greatest possible success of that game I can imagine. It's like Yeah, exactly. We have led people to pick up Merkborg so they can
be a duck. That Duckburg is very much also a visual art piece and not just a game. The visuals of it matter to it.
Yeah, because otherwise it doesn't work. Like, a plain text version. Like, we should provide a plain text version so people can access that information without their eyeballs exploding. But, like, also, you know, like, it's a response to Merkboard.
The object itself is a thing of value.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's complicated. Making games, man. It's a whole thing.
We're kind of trying to figure out the line between makes it sound like they are distinct things in a way that I no longer believe they are, but for lack of a better phrase, the line between making a game and making an art, been sort of toying with figuring out how they can be the same thing and how that can overlap while figuring out how to also make these now art pieces accessible. Mm-hmm. It's a fun adventure of game design.
Yeah, I often think about the combination of like what is game as an art form, right? And I think that there are definitely some correlations because they're both experiential and they're both determined by the projections of the people who are engaging with it at the time. So that's always my link between the two things. And as far as like talking about
with LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thinking about accessibility as a part of the workflow for the two of you, and I would hope for anyone listening to this, sort of, I had just had a conversation with Chris Bissett yesterday, per the recording of this episode, that accessibility is just something that should be thought about, considered a little bit more in terms of just on the outset, because a lot of it's not really difficult to do when you think about releasing a plain text document of your game. Like, one, that's your ash can if you don't have the experience with Affinity Designer or Adobe Illustrator or don't have the money to buy those things. You extend your audience so much more when you think about the electronic advantages of EPUB readers and Mobi readers and everything to that effect, right? And I think that moving forward in a modern game design landscape, that accessibility should be, we actually talked about, like, because me and Spencer Campbell are on this live design hype train, and one of the things I think about when you create a sole digital virtual tabletop RPG experience, you can do some cool things with art direction too, like color blind modes and stuff like that as well, when people are like reading those PDFs or want to download those versions of the books to be more accessible. Because I have a colorblind friend who can't see, like, I think blues and greens are very hard for them. And some art, like, kind of escapes them because they hit that analogous form of color design or color theory or whatever have you, color combination science. I know what it is. But yeah, I think you touched on some really cool things that I think designers should really think about going forward for their products. And I love that you are in the depths of really trying to figure it out for your own design principles. And I think that's very cool. Dan, Collie, This is the section of the show where I ask you, you know, what are some trends you're seeing in your social circles and your game design networks? It doesn't necessarily have to be just design principles, but like publishing trends or something to that effect, marketing trends. What are some trends that you're seeing that you're really liking? If there are any trends that you feel are detractful to the tabletop scene, would you like to caution people against those things? And then, is there any trends within you that you want to speak into the ether that you think people should explore a little bit more?
I feel like we talked about what we were going to say in Trend Town, and then we burnt all of that material by dovetailing into...
We already tangented, but I do,
you know, so everything we said earlier about accessibility,
art pieces,
all that stuff, still true.
Trends that we are very interested in pursuing ourselves and in seeing other people doing.
Yeah, and the only thing I would tack on to the art piece thing is, like, I think a lot of designers, or maybe they don't, maybe I'm projecting, I don't know. But I think there's this idea that, like, viewing your game as an art piece is mutually exclusive from sitting down at a table with your friends and some drinks and some pretzels and going and bonking goblins on the head and having a good time. Like that, and I think that's not true.
Yeah, we want both. We want you to be able to look at the thing that we've created and really appreciate it as an object, and then take that object and have a good time with it with your friends.
Yeah, like we, Gem Room Games, we're still trying to think of the better term for beer and pretzel games. Of just like, you know, this, like Subway Runners is a goofy time that uses randomizers to create silly results. And like, that's what we want to be making. And that's what we're comfortable with. And that's what we enjoy writing.
Generally, if you are playing one of our games, we hope that you're getting some laughs.
Yeah, but that doesn't, that... If you are designing games with that in mind, that does not absolve you of thinking through your work as an art piece, even if the goal is to make a comedy or to make something that is light in nature. So that, you know, it's you have to do that too, even if you're not writing something incredibly emotionally revealing about yourself, but instead are just like, I thought of a cool way to fight liches. I don't know. But a trend that... Given my soapbox that I will stand on, given the slightest provocation with Itch.io specifically, because they're so close, is, and we talked about this a little bit on your other show, on the Colin show, but the just getting revenue sharing up on Itch will, I think, if we can get that, or if Itch.io can get that, because you can do it for bundles. It's just the bundle that never ends. Come on. Because once that functionality unlocks, that is going to, I think, open up a lot of not only collaboration within the tabletop RPG space without having to do the organizational overhead of okay, we're gonna have a, like, I mean, you should probably have like an agreement or whatever, but like, you know, like you don't have to form an LLC every time you want to, you know, do a jam with your buddies and make the same game. But also, we forget about this sometimes, but it turns out there's more than physical games on Itch.io. There's video games on Itch.io, it turns out. And being able to do revenue sharing is going to open up the somewhat inaccessible trend that Lancer has, and I mean, technically, you know, like I've seen what Wizards of the Coast does with a digital tool. You know, I feel like they really got to get some nerds working on it. That's my spicy take. They got to, if only they could find someone who knew. Okay, maybe that can be redacted from the episode. I don't know if I need. I don't know if we need to invoke the name of Wizards of the Coast.
And summon them.
Yeah, and I can't call it the Dragon Game because we've got a new, better Dragon Game now. But
yeah.
But you know, digital tools for tabletop RPGs are a thing I always love to see. CompCon makes Lancer playable to me as a person who does not have time to build a mech and like run it. You know, we used Perchance, which is...
For Subway Runners,
we used Perchance. That was really successful, and we also ran into limitations on what it could do very quickly. And being able to talk to someone who makes video games and say, hey, we've got this idea for like this companion app for a game, or a game that's built around a companion app so that it can do stuff that you can't normally do, you know, roll a 14-sided die and make, you know, a character sheet out of just dropping cards on a thing, that kind of thing. We can't do that now because that's software development, and that's a whole... Oh boy, that is a big thing to bite off. But if we could talk to someone and say, hey, we'll write the game, you make the app, we'll figure out who gets what cut of the money, and let's just do this thing, would make that possible for us to start doing bespoke stuff without feeling like either we're taking someone for a ride on, you know, on their largesse, or...
on without the hassle of being like, all right, we'll send you a check for... $4.17 next month, and figure out exactly what your cut's going to be the following month, and do that in perpetuity.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, it's not necessarily a new take, but it is something that I really, really think, you know, Leaf, if you're out there, I love Itch.io. I started making games on it exclusively as soon as I realized I could, but man, oh man, oh man. That's gonna once you flip that switch. I'm sure it's much more complicated than flipping a switch. Once you flip that switch, it's like there's gonna be an explosion of like really creative stuff that is gonna really bridge some very interesting gaps. Also, if we can get revenue sharing with Bandcamp, so I can finally make the tabletop RPG that has a soundtrack that you can buy as a cassette. Oh man, it's gonna. You know, there's a lot that could potentially happen there.
Dan will be tinkering on that one for ages.
Yeah, so that's I'm manifesting revenue sharing on Itch because I don't want to do a Kickstarter. Please, I do not want to do it. It seems very stressful. I want to make games and occasionally get beer money from them. But yeah,
Collie, any trends to add on to that?
You know, I think I've covered most of the trends. I know I tend to not be as present in the sort of social world of RPGs as Dan, so a lot of my awareness of trends takes the form of, like, Dan running up to me with a zine and saying, look at this, and I do, and I go, wow, yeah, that's cool, and then we put it back on the bookshelf so that our daughter doesn't lovingly try to eat it, and that sort of curates my awareness of trends.
Yeah. I love zine games, and I also... She really likes Mothership, is the thing. And she keeps grabbing the Mothership zines down, and they're fragile a bit.
It's the colors. Would you happen to have, potentially, because this is a unique opportunity... Would you have any trends like outside of the game, like maybe something more towards visual design or artistic design in any facet that maybe you are that you like seeing in games or that you have been enjoying seeing in games that Dan presents to you in an open look at this format?
Something that we had talked about before the interview that we haven't mentioned yet was about making games that are kind of like fun to read as well as, you know, like not just sort of a dry reference text.
The thing that is enjoyable, even if you can't get your group of friends together to actually play it.
Which, you know, I mean, the joke is, you know, like how many games do you buy and how many games have you actually played? And the answer is shut up.
Don't talk to me.
Yeah, don't talk to me about that. I don't know you, stranger danger. But I do think something that I love to see it every time is like a clear, like I always appreciate those sort of hints of the designer's voice, and that may not be, you know, I might have a taste for that, and it may be an acquired taste, but I like writing games and in a sort of naturalistic way and trying to articulate the difference between, okay, no, this is how dice are rolled and so on. And you should probably do this, but you're an adult, have fun. So like that sort of consideration in writing, I think, is something, you know, we do to varying degrees of success. There wasn't a lot of room for it in Neutron Axe, but it's something that I'm hoping, you know, Like, I don't know if it counts as a trend. I think people do it or they don't, depending on how they like to write. But I always, you know, if you're new, like, yeah, let it fly. Like, yeah. Speak naturally.
I was just thinking, also, not necessarily a trend, but we were talking the other day about what makes some comedies work when others don't. Mm-hmm. And what we were identifying is sincerity, because you can write something that you think is the funniest thing, but if you're being kind of an a-hole about it, or not really believing in what you do, then something that's sort of, you know, B-, it's gonna really feel B-. But if you believe in it and make it with love and sincerity and really feel it, that comes across. And I think that we were talking a lot about, like, some Vin Diesel movies, for example. There's a sincerity that, you know, everybody really enjoyed making that and put that love into it. And that comes across. And that's something that I think also comes across, for example, in RPGs. You can tell when somebody really enjoyed what they were working on and loved working on it. And I like to think that everybody can tell that we're enjoying our games and having fun with them ourselves.
Yeah. When I read a game, I want to know something that the designer loves. I want to read, you know, like, I don't know very much about cars, but I want, you know, I'm always excited to read a game about cars written by someone who clearly knows what a slip differential is and cares enough to take me on that journey. It's something to do with drift racing. I don't know. It came up when I got way too into, like, Grand Theft Auto 5. Like, I should not know what that is. But, yeah. Yeah, I think love. I think love is a good trend.
It's, you know, love.
Let's end on that note.
Family, love, sincerity.
We don't have to end the interview, but I feel like that's a good trend. I like that.
Love and trend. Yeah, I know that Adam Bell has a really cool sense of voice. Like, I feel like Adam is talking to me whenever I read one of his games. And I get the same sense from your games as well, at least for Duckborg, from what I've read. I feel a lot of, like, flavor and, like, I feel like one of you is standing on the table reading the beginning excerpt to me, and it just feels very nice. I love games like that. And I agree, I think there is definitely this change up from game as reference material into game as a narrative adventure for the reader, which is very cool. Let's talk about Neutron Axe then.
Yeah.
Because I think we got a lot of cool tips from the trends in the first section as well.
So let's see. Neutron Axe, we dropped.
So we dropped that one, I think, 2 days ago. It's Gemroom Games' first original rule set our first in-text original art coming from Gemroom Games and our first trifold. So.
Yeah, basically. So we did Duckburg, and instead of being reasonable adults who take a break between projects, I really wanted, I had this idea, and it's sort of my, this kind of, this is, it's, I'm not used to doing mechanics first design. That's, like, not usually how I do. So this felt very George Lucasian, like, I've got this great bit of dice tech, and I need a game to put it in. And so it bounced around as a lot of different things. It was going to be sort of this Mandalorian-inspired space western, because I realized that the .dot rodeo suffix for a website is really cheap. So I was going to write a game called Tachyon Rodeo, and then, like, I'd have that website. It'd be great. And then
sick.
That immediately got out of scope and was going to take way too long to do. And then it was going to be a 2400 hack, but we kind of took, We kind of decided, actually, we wanted this to be new enough. Like, it is inspired by the way dice work in 2400 and in Blades in the Dark. But I'm pretty sure, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, but I'm pretty sure it's new enough that we can call it our own rule set. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Man, it's wild out here.
You know, if somebody wants to write in and be like, oh, you totally copied this other thing, then oops
is our position.
That's how the human subconscious works, dude. So yeah. It's chill.
Mm. But yeah, so we had this rule set, and we were going to make it a hack, then we didn't want to make it a hack because we wanted other people to be able to make hacks of it and point to it. And then I got frustrated and wrote down a bunch of cool words and started just mashing them together to make titles until we came up with Neutron County, which immediately got out of scope again, because then I realized I had to make a county because it's on the title. So then I realized Trifold Jam was happening. I said, great, I can't, that's going to, if I run out of a single piece of paper, then I have to stop writing words, which was really useful for getting this out in the world. And we changed it to Neutron Axe, and
because, you know, an axe, it's a tool, and this is a tool.
Yeah. and just filled it with purple prose of, like, weird fantasy, like, you know, fun stuff. So I can't help myself very quickly. The mechanic I'm excited about, which I learned a long time ago, that you can't sell games by telling people about dice mechanics that you're really excited about. But I'm going to do that anyways, because this is a safe space, which is essentially, if you're familiar with Overwatch and how Overwatch mm-hmm. has armor and shields, it does something very similar with dice, where if you, there's light, medium, and heavy weapons, and heavy weapons, when you hurt someone with them, you roll 1d12, and with light weapons, you roll 3d4. So they have the same maximum, you know, different probability curves, and three four-sided dice. The minimum you're going to get is 3 as opposed to 1. But armor subtracts its value from each die you roll. So if you're armored, then all of a sudden it's really negatively impacting people who are using fast, light weapons, and people who are using, one, you know, big weapons can get past that with way less of an impact.
So, narratively, your shield is good at protecting you from one big attack, but weak to lots of little attacks. Your armor is the inverse. It offers some protection against many small attacks, but not much against big ones. So, like, one hit from a huge mace will probably smash your armor in, but your shield can take that blow. On the other hand, a little knife going stab, stab, stab from multiple directions, that's going to get around your shield, but your armor will protect you from all of those angles.
So the way the dice works is when you effectively hit with a small weapon, you do 3d4 damage, so you get to roll 3 four-sided dice, as opposed to a big weapon where you get to roll 1 12-sided dice. And so what it ends up creating is this sense where it feels like you're rolling something, when you're using a small weapon, you're rolling something small, and maybe no one of these is going to do a lot, but they're, as a group, they're dangerous, you know, a bunch of light pointy things, as opposed to a big heavy 12-sided die. And then the way shields work is they absorb damage, but they only absorb from one die at a time. And the way armor works is they subtract the amount of damage you take from each die that gets rolled. So your armor is way more effective at impacting these small light weapons, but not nearly as effective as, like, potentially one big 12-sided die roll. So, and yeah, the way, like, magic, you know, or science fiction or whatever, shields work is they absorb from one die. So it, you know, like your fast stuff will get around shields, and your big heavy thing it'll absorb the singular blow. So it's this mm-hmm. like little very small bit of dice tech to make kind of tactical fights that I'm very excited about, and it's very okay if retroactively you're just joining us now back in the podcast after hitting the go forward 15 seconds thing. But so the, so it, you know, like that's something that I really want to build out. I think it'll be really fun to play with. And then Neutron Axe is essentially how big of a game we can make that fits on one sheet where, you know, instead of attributes, you have your four classes, which are, you know, your standard, your, there's hunter, mutant, hacker, and witch. You know, the classic four Dungeons & Dragons tropes. And what they're good at, and, you know, you get bigger dice in them for, you know, doing appropriate tasks appropriate to the, you know, burning demon skull, harvesting motherboards from cyborgs, that kind of thing. But,
yeah.
So we're, and I keep meaning to sit down and write out a big rambling blog post about it so that we can have a dev blog for it. But the goal was, you know, we didn't have a lot of room to write this big setting guide or whatever. We had like a paragraph to be like, it's crazy. Like there's cyborgs and it's radiation and a maelstrom, whatever. So a lot of what we did was to say, okay, well, you level up as a mutant by... Wait, I already did that one. You level up as a hunter by, like, purifying blight hearts with salt. And later on, like, oh, if you kill a slime monster, you get a blight heart. And it's sort of like, okay, great. So now we know a couple things about this world. Mm-hmm. What does a blight heart look like? How much does it weigh? I have no idea, and frankly, I don't care. Like, it's your game. But, like, it's enough to be like, okay, well...
There's the sort of A to B to C of, okay, so if slime monsters have blight hearts and you spend blight hearts to advance, well, then you've got to go out and get a slime monster.
Yeah, like there's reason to go out and deal with slime monsters and why it matters that, you know, like why it matters to hunters that there are no more blight hearts is it's definitely something that I would love to hear about.
We built in a lot of room for the GM to find their own take on the story. A
lot of negative space. Mm-hmm. You know, by which I mean we ran out of room. I almost forgot to include a way to get hit points back. Like, we have hit points, and then you get hurt, and then we were like, okay, we're done. And then I was like, oh, wait, I've got to delete something so that you're not just in an endless death spiral, but like... Yeah,
we already wrote that game.
If you get a good night's sleep, you get hit points back. So, and then it was, I thought it was going to be an ash can. And then Kali said, well, we can do this if I get to do the layout. And so it actually looks really nice. I'm looking at one of our ones that we were trying to get the panel order right so that when we print it out. But yeah, and then I essentially handed Kali this sort of manuscript. And then all of a sudden she was drawing like custom icons for it and stuff. And it looks really nice. I'm really pleased.
I'm pleased. It looks great. And I had a ton of fun reading it. And I think one of the really big things, like I love the dice tech. I remember you like poking at the brain trust when you came up with it. And I think it's very cool. Like having sort of a subtraction factor applying to individual dice instead of total number is a very interesting thing, especially when you consider the context in which you've placed it, right? Smaller, lighter weapons are less effective against one type, more effective against another type. And it's almost like you formed this rock, paper, scissors situation within the game. And I love also this concept of like class as stats, and that sort of defines your character. And I think just those two big pieces are something that I will now think about in my game. So I've already learned by reading Neutron Axe. It's amazing.
Yeah. That was what got out of hand with Neutron County was the like in that one, it was like faction relationship as stats, and then all of a sudden I was like writing out the narrative like background on like six different government agencies, and it was getting it was like this is not
a one-pager,
this is not a one-week project that we can like knock out so that I can stop obsessing about like getting this idea out in the world. So it's yeah, we accidentally seeded ourselves with like five different games as part of this because we don't have enough to do.
You know, we'll add them onto the list of all the other games that we've been excited to make and just haven't gotten to yet because there's this life thing that keeps happening.
Oh, speaking of which, if you bought High Magic Low Lives, I promise we are going to make an adventure for it. We said we would make an adventure for it. We're going
to
make it.
So close to done.
You will get it for free. We just need to finish writing it. It's it's working in parallel with Duckburg. We haven't forgotten you. It's going to be great. I just have to rewatch the GDC video on Hitman 6 more times because I'm obsessed with it. And then write an adventure. And it's going to be great. You're going to love it.
Well, you heard it here first, everyone. It's coming. Nowhere else.
Yeah. It's 2 years late, but we didn't actually say when we'd do it. So what is time?
Time's meaningless these days anyway.
Yeah.
We make it up.
We really are going to do it. And I'm sorry it took this long. And we love you. Thank you for supporting our first game.
Aw. I love it. Yeah, this is a very cool trifold for the jam as well. Like, there's just a lot when you were talking about sort of the A to B to C lore setting, like key, like basically a keyword setting. And I think more and more because I had, like I said, I had Chris Bissett on here a while ago, and for the Dice Souls game, they have written in like lore questions, like you answer questions about the world based on these prompts that each monster or each region gives you, and that's sort of shaping your goal throughout this campaign. What I like about this sort of like keyword setting design is, like you said, you have a lot of negative space for people, but these keywords are also easily replaceable, right? I could replace slime with werewolf if I wanted to change the tone of the game, right? I could change Blightheart with anything. Silver, I don't know. But I think what's really cool about this style of design is that it's versatile, and all it really needs is the base mechanics to sort of play this game. Otherwise, you're playing a different game, right? If you changed out the dice resolution system, you wouldn't be playing Neutron Axe anymore, I think. But if you changed out the word hacker to something else, or any one of those like sort of keywords, you'd still be playing Neutron Axe to some effect. And I think that's very cool and very smart.
Yeah, I'm really excited to write out a version that is intended for people to swap stuff out of, just mm-hmm. like, because it doesn't need to be classes. I just didn't want to do, you know, intelligence mm-hmm. as a stat again, mm-hmm. you know, like there's like a lot of different ways you could tweak it, but there's sort of this essential core of it, and then sort of helping people build out from it, and then, you know, make it so like it's easy to make something that, you know, fits on a trifold but is your own setting and just uses the dice. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to get into that later, because we got
a backlog.
We've cut so many checks and they're gonna and we gotta cash them. Like, we gotta...
Well, and granted, a lot of those checks we're cutting to ourselves.
Yeah,
also.
But I...
But there's a lot that we're excited to make.
Yeah. We keep telling people we're going to make stuff is the problem. and then you should do it because you said you'd do it.
Such is the curse of powerful designers with very wrinkly brains. You just never stop shooting out ideas and you never stop getting held by them. The other day, I've been playing a lot of Monster Hunter Rise, and I recently just had like an idea where what if there is a game where like everyone has a deck of cards. One deck is like an AI monster situation, and then your weapon type turns it into like a deck builder, and it's like a greatsword deck only has high numbers, and you're trying to play blackjack against the enemy deck without busting so you can land your hit. And there's like another version where you're playing Go Fish with the monster deck at the same time. Like, just these sort of like intricate, you're playing different card game things, and but I still have to work on Kaleidoscope. And that can't stop, otherwise it'll never be done.
If you haven't, there's a video game called Dicey Dungeons that I strongly recommend, because it does a lot of that stuff in really smart ways. Of like, you know, sometimes you want a lot of ones, and sometimes you want the biggest numbers you can get, and it like ties that to different things in really smart ways. That sounds rad. I love when games do that. I love when games like evoke the feel of different stuff. Like, through, I mean, and you know, the first, like, Dread introduced that concept to me in a pretty big way. And I think that was a lot of people's sort of first experience of like, oh, playing Jenga feels like a horror movie. and mm-hmm. we're playing a horror movie with Jenga. What a concept. And I think, you know, like you said, like what feels like Go Fish, and like how do you, you know, of all these fantasy weapons, like which one feels the most like blackjack or poker or mm-hmm. you know, yeah, three card Monty.
Oh shit, is that it? Is that a Bennett game? Hold on. Sorry, writing that down.
Is this just the sort of find the lady and then make the the shell game. Netrunner's
good. Oh, that'd
be
so good.
I'm very excited that Netrunner has more cards coming out. That's a whole different thing. But yeah.
Yes, Neutron Axe is very cool, and I'm already teeming with ideas. Anything else you want to sort of add to the design principles behind Neutron Axe?
Not yet. I mean, the short answer is yes, but we need to write them, because it's like I said, we, you know... Right now, a hot meal and a good night's sleep heals 1d12 of your hit points. Like, that's good, but I think that might benefit from a little more time on under mm-hmm. the knife.
I think Neutron X really benefited from having a well-timed jam.
Yeah.
That helped us to just get this idea out there.
Thank you, Keegan.
Prior to the jam, we were talking a lot about, like, okay, well, could Dan just write a blog post? Would that get the idea out in the world? Was it enough to tell the Brain Trust? What was enough to get this out into the world so that mm-hmm. we could start working on it and thinking about everything else going on? And then came this wonderfully timed jam that provided us the medium that we needed to get that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love that there's like a larger scope behind this game. Like, I feel like, one, this can potentially be like a very cool hackable game. Like, I think this has a lot of like Blades in the Dark common license energy, which is awesome. Not to make like a 1-to-1 comparison, but just to be like, you know, like I said, there's a lot of keywords that can be switched around in here, and there's a lot of like really cool mechanics and delineations that you find throughout just these six panels, which is very, very awesome. So I think this is, you know, If from my perspective, it's the $1 million idea as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm always thrilled to be compared to Blades in the Dark. Do not mind that one bit. But yeah, that's lovely. That's my hope for it, is that it, you know, like we'll keep making Duckburgs as long as people keep buying them. But we have so much cartoon animal in dark fantasy ideas, you don't even know.
We've been working on a cartoon animal dark fantasy game since before Gem Room Games was Gem Room Games.
Yeah.
It just keeps getting out of scope. And then we start working on something else to do an in-scope project, so
we're keeping an eye on what Possible Worlds is doing with their Kickstarter 6-game set, and mm-hmm. we're just gonna let's see how that works, because I think that might be what named have we named it on the internet yet? Is it are we NDA'd to ourselves
about our cool modular game system inspired by earlier works published under It's Dan Phipps?
Yeah, this is getting oblique very quickly. But we're like, stay tuned for that.
Yeah,
we'll get that together.
I swear, it's coming out within the next decade.
Yeah, someday.
Stay tuned to games.
Yeah.
I think that's a missed opportunity there.
Stay tuned games is actually very good. We're committed to this brand. We've got dozens of followers on Twitter. If you don't need it, Jeremy, then one of your listeners, that's a freebie for you. You can pick that one up.
With that, then, I think that'll draw us to the close. See what I did there? It's in the name. Dan, Collie, it has been an absolute pleasure having you both on here at the same time. Could go ahead, tell people where they can find you, get your stuff. All these links will be in the show notes down below.
So our games can be found at gemroomgames.itch.io. And you can also follow us on Twitter at gemroomgames. I think we I think we grabbed a bunch of social media that we never ended up using. I think we have an Instagram, but we haven't used it. So yeah. Feel free to follow that. We will not, you won't see
maybe
a lot of pictures.
Someday we might post something.
Yeah, we gotta,
we're really trying not to spam your accounts.
Yeah, exactly. This is definitely a choice and not a result of being exhausted literally all the time. But we're making games again. I'm thrilled. But yeah, so the best place to find out what we're working on is Gemrim Games on Twitter. Follow us on itch.io, and you'll get a little deedly-dee that tells you when we've released a new game. My personal is It's Dan Phipps on Twitter, and I tweet about game design in more abstract ways there sometimes, and complain about records management.
Mm-hmm. I don't really tweet about much game design, but you can find me at Kali Law, which also both of us are linked from the Gemrim Games account.
Yep, go to Gemrim Games. That's where the good stuff is. Yeah,
perfect. Well, everyone, I hope you've had fun listening to Dan and Kali, because I know I have. I learned a lot. And we will see you next time. Say bye to the people, family.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, God, I'm doing the Violet thing. Yeah. I'm saying goodbye in the way to make Violet say goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Oh, my God. I swear I'm an adult.
All right, that's a wrap. Dan and Kali, thank you for being the first co-op power couple on the show, and Gemrim Games is an inspiration for the future of game design. All the games we talked about today, along with all the links to get in touch with Dan and Kali and Gemrim Games, will be down below in the show notes for your access. If you liked the show and found it helpful, send a tip my way by following the link tree in the show notes to my Ko-fi or Venmo profiles. Or, if you are unable to provide monetary support, you can provide support at no cost by sharing this with someone you thought of while listening to this episode and leaving a review. Both of these methods greatly impact the success of this show and lets me know that what I'm doing is beneficial to designers out there. If you want to be a part of the conversation or hang out with the alumni from the show, like Dan and Kali, you can join the DYD House Discord server. Thanks for listening, and I will catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.